content of this program is intended for people who are print and visually impaired. It's underwritten by the law firm of Nair & Wenzel with offices in Raleigh and Smithfield. And my name is Joe Austin, and I'm your host for today's episode of Legal Matters, an original program produced in the North Carolina Reading Service studio. For the next half hour, we'll be exploring topics. Well, we won't be doing that today. We're going to have a Christmas program. So instead of exploring the Americans with Disabilities Act and things of that nature, we're going to talk about the law and Christmas. And Richard Pascal is my guest today. Richard, thank you.
Glad to be here, Joe.
Great. And Richard is not only a lawyer, but he is also a historian and has his law degree and a Ph.D. in history. So we're really pleased to have you today, Richard, and I probably need to do some more introductory things, but I want to get into your background and all of that. But just for your information, we broadcast this program every fourth Tuesday of each month. And normally we provide news and information on federal and state agencies as well as nonprofit organizations that promote information on laws supporting independent living. But today I thought, well, we're close to Christmas, and so that's what we're going to explore today, the law and Christmas. And there's nobody in Raleigh anyway better qualified to do that than you, I think. So thanks for joining us.
Christmas law is a cutting-edge field of legal inquiry.
I heard that. So Richard, tell us a little bit about yourself. You've got a varied background here, and been in academics and also a practicing lawyer.
I am. I grew up in the town of Wake Forest right outside of Raleigh. My grandfather was a professor at the college when Wake Forest College was there, and spent first 18 years here in the area, and then moved away from college and graduate school and law school, and then had a clerkship in New Orleans, and then lived in Washington, D.C. for the next 10 years, but came back, and currently I practice at Schwartz & Shaw. And we do education law. We represent public school districts from one end of the state to the other and help them with all of their legal needs.
And I know that in the past you've also been professor of law at Campbell, and I think you taught the legal history course there as well.
I did. I have taught legal history there at Campbell. And I've taught it at George Mason's Law School up in Arlington, Virginia, which is now the Antonin Scalia School of Law, or Law School, I think. They've changed it now because of the initials.
Right.
But I did go to Johns Hopkins and get a Ph.D., and I continue to do some scholarship in my spare time. I have a book coming out this coming year, entitled Jim Crow in North Carolina, the Legislative Program from 1865 to 1920. And that book is about the Jim Crow statutes here in North Carolina in every legislative session from 1865 to 1920. And that covers a good period of important North Carolina history in which Reconstruction and the last decades of the 19th century led to a reaction against African Americans, their disenfranchisement, and there were a lot of statutes passed, obviously, with regard to streetcars and railroads and steamboats and everything else that segregated and discriminated in numerous ways.
Well, very timely and topical even now, so I know you're excited about that coming out. So Richard, you've done a little research into Christmas and the law. Can you share some of that with our listeners?
Well, I guess the first thing to say is law is just pervasive in society. It touches virtually every aspect of our lives, and that's certainly true today. There are certainly laws in cities such as Philadelphia and New York that do not allow Christmas trees in anything but one- and two-family dwellings. That's mainly for as a fire hazard and not as a prohibition on Christmas trees. But the real law involving Christmas may be traced back to the time of the Puritans. And they were different than the Pilgrims. We often confuse the two, but they both came out of a reaction to the Church of England in the 1600s, and they, the Puritans and Pilgrims, felt like Christmas had become too festive. There was a lot of drinking, a lot of parading, bear baiting, all kinds of activities that were not in alignment with what they believed that the Christmas season should be about. And so the Puritans, who the difference between the Puritans and the Pilgrims were also known as separatists, and they wanted to essentially separate from the Church of England. The Pilgrims, on the other hand, the Puritans, on the other hand, had a lot in common with the Pilgrims, but they thought that the Church of England could be reformed from within. They both decided to come to America. The Puritans had a lot of money. The danger for the separatists and the Pilgrims was, because they wanted to separate from the Church of England, they were in danger of losing their homes and land. And so when they came to Plymouth, which was the Pilgrim settlement in Massachusetts, they didn't have a lot of money. The Puritans, on the other hand, were not in danger of losing their property because they were working within the system, within the Church of England. And so when they came and set up the Massachusetts Bay Colony, they had interest in probably two things. One was just as a good investment opportunity to come to the New World. And second, they thought that they could essentially set up a new wing of the Church of England that would be purer and more to their liking as opposed to the church in England. And the Puritans first started off by, in surprise, outlawing Christmas. Again, because of the drinking, because of the parading, sometimes interrupting church services, they wanted to do away with Christmas, and that was the case in England as well. The Cromwell regime, the Roundheads, were by and large Puritans, and they wanted to do away with Christmas as well. Here in the New World in Massachusetts, they outlawed through a Massachusetts Bay statute Christmas, and it reads as follows: "For preventing disorders arising in several places within this jurisdiction, by reason of some still observing such festivals as were superstitiously kept in other countries, to the great dishonor of God and offense of others, it is therefore ordered by this church and the authority thereof that whosoever shall be found observing any such day as Christmas or the like, either by forbearing of labor, feasting, or any other way upon such accounts as aforesaid, every such person so offending shall pay for every such offense 5 shillings as a fine to the country." So they were not fans, and there were sermons by well-known Puritans such as Increase Mather and his better-known son Cotton Mather going into the 1700s against the evils of Christmas. And so Christmas was not did not start out on good footing in terms of recognition here, and many times they wanted the shops to remain open, the Puritans, in order to ensure that no one was feasting and drinking mainly, intended for the shops to stay open and business to be conducted as usual.
Well, isn't that ironic that they would keep the shops open, commerce would continue as if there was something mutually exclusive about it, and here in modern times, the shops are certainly open during Christmas time, and maybe not on Christmas Day, but you know, they commercialized, and so they're sort of running hand in glove. Very ironic that we went from a puritanical approach or non celebration of Christmas to something that is commercial and the reason for the season. But I mean that's traditional songs like Wassail and just the idea of the wassail, which I think is an alcoholic drink, perhaps.
Very much.
That's
so.
What they so the Puritans were reacting against all of that and the partying and whatnot. And so where did the current attitudes towards Christmas, how did they kind of creep into our culture?
Well, relatively late, as far as things go, federal government did not recognize, and the federal government does not have power. No one thinks it has power to mandate holidays at the state level or for private businesses. But the federal government does have power to set federal holidays. And so the federal government was very late in coming to establishing federal holidays to start with, and Christmas in particular, because they did not have a statute until the 1870s allowing federal employees in the District of Columbia to take Christmas Day off. They established more than just Christmas Day with that statute. They set aside New Year's Day as well and a couple of others. But that wasn't generalized to federal employees as a whole until 1885. And that the federal government was, to some degree, late to the party. A lot of states, of course, had, after the Puritans no longer controlled things and the Massachusetts Bay Colony became Massachusetts, a lot of states certainly had statutes allowing certain days off and certain aspects of Christmas to be different than all other days. In the 1830s, Louisiana established a law which made Christmas a day of grace, by which they meant that it was a day in which if you had a debt due, you didn't have to pay it. So you got a day with no interest, and you didn't have to pay the debt off until the next day, the 26th. So that they called Christmas a day of grace, and that's where we get the phrase grace period and such as that. Other states followed suit. Arkansas had a law like that in the 1830s as well. So in terms of establishing holidays and special times at Christmas, nothing happened until the 19th century, and the big 800-pound gorilla in the room, the federal government, wasn't fully on board until 1885. So it's a relatively recent occurrence. You know, when you think of 400 plus years of American history,
that's an interesting phenomenon. I mean, we talk about the non recognition of Christmas or a celebration of it in the Puritan New England, in the austere New England, but quite a different attitude toward it and a sensibility in Louisiana. Which, you know, Wynton Marsalis, I think, in the jazz series put on by Kenneth Burns, talked about New Orleans being gumbo. It was a place where all sorts of people came together and expect that to be more of a party spirit down there.
I think that's right. My federal clerkship was with a judge in New Orleans, so I lived in New Orleans for a year, and Louisiana, because of the river, because it was a port, any port's going to have a lot of people from all kinds of places, but that was certainly true with the Spanish influence and then the French influence that followed after the French took over Louisiana from the Spanish, and then with the Anglos coming in. I mean, there was a very distinct difference between the French Creoles and the Acadians who lived a little bit to the west in what they term Acadiana over in Lafayette around there. And Louisiana is very much a gumbo of people.
And so we've got two poles there, the Puritan New England and then the New Orleans in the South, and with its French and Spanish influence. In your research, did you find that immigration had any effect on the increased awareness of Christmas but the sensibility of celebrating it?
I think so. I can't pretend to know a lot about the immigration behind this, but it's certainly the case that the Roundheads in England, you know, were sort of outliers, and Christmas traditions on the continent and in the Church of England itself, because the Cromwell only had a brief reign of 20 or so odd years. There were a lot of different traditions on the continent and in France and Germany and obviously in the southern European countries as well as migration over the 20th century from Eastern Europe and the Middle East and from Asia, mainly coming in on the West Coast, who were not part of the Christmas tradition, but those people that came across the Atlantic, at least, brought a very, very varied idea of how Christmas should be celebrated. It was more in line with the festive atmosphere that we know today than the Puritan approach. And so I would say that immigration definitely helped shift priorities and make things less austere than they might have been otherwise.
Right. I think the Christmas tree originated in Germany, and certainly they're bringing the good malt beverages over from Germany with them. So wassail and ale and beer and even wine. So anyway, the party's just getting started now. So
right.
Have you sensed that any of those legal issues have crept into or have any atavistic remnants in the current culture, or have we just turned the page totally on that?
Well, they're all kind of rumblings out. I mean, America is so diverse. You can, if you want to find a viewpoint, you're certainly going to be able to find it. But there are always, speaking from where I sit as someone who works with schools, there are a lot of people who want to celebrate Christmas and who would welcome the opportunity to do that in schools and in other government facilities to a degree that perhaps contravenes most courts' understanding of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. But there's certainly been a feeling over the last decade or so that Christmas has been unduly burdened, and there are no laws outlawing Merry Christmas, obviously, but some people have felt like the Christmas spirit and is being stepped upon. But really, when you get down to it, the law doesn't have a lot to say in terms of the celebration and whether someone says Merry Christmas or not. It may have a role to say in what a school can put on in terms of a holiday program, but it can't control what people say in that kind of fashion.
It gets a little tricky, doesn't it? I mean, we got the Establishment Clause and in public schools. I mean, I don't give away any of your cases or anything like that, but I'm sure that is an issue that you all have to confront in your practice, isn't it?
It sure is. I mean, just as a general rule, you know, there are a lot of school boards and county commissioners and know, all kinds of local government agencies who, when they start their meetings, would, if given their preference, would start it with a prayer. And, you know, that has had a very complex legal history, and all of the religion cases, whether you're talking about a nativity scene on the courthouse square, or whether you can have a non-sectarian prayer at the start of a county commissioner meeting or whatever, are all so complicated, and the courts have had such a time trying to fashion any kind of guidance and standards, aside from the fact that you can't come out full bore and violate the Establishment Clause, that you know, the creches and nativity scenes often end up having Santa Claus and a menorah and other cartoon characters like Rudolph as a way of kind of minimizing the Christian flavor of those displays.
Well, the we were kidding before we went on to record about Miracle on 34th Street, but that that is a movie, a very popular movie, and it's been done over and over again. But very interesting that it ends up
in a courtroom
with Kris Kringle and a disability issue of sorts, and whether Kris Kringle is competent to even be on the streets and not get put away. So that an interesting twist there.
And, Edward Gwynn does a fantastic job as Kris Kringle, and you know it just has a wonderful charm on. You know, with the adults who are set and dyed in wool that this can't possibly be Santa Claus or Kris Kringle or whoever he says he is, and by golly, we need to have a competency hearing, and why is he substituting at Macy's and maintaining that he is Kris Kringle? So it's a really wonderful kind of mashup of the cynicism of adults and the purity of children.
And both Richard and I can rush to assure our listeners that the judges on the benches in North Carolina don't have their political advisor telling them how to rule on cases. So that's a funny aspect of that movie in that case.
No one sitting on the bench today, and I don't know that it was really all that prevalent when the movie was made back in the 40s, had anything approaching the kind of political advice that judge was getting off the bench.
And then the rules of evidence kind of go out the window, don't they, with the bags of mail coming from the post office.
Right. Who knows who produced such letters? How outrageous that this could all be a plot by Mr. Kringle.
All that hearsay. Oh my goodness! And the lack of
question whether it's original document.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So anyway, but a happy ending there. Anything else about the legal aspects of Christmas that our listeners might enjoy? Richard.
Well, the law, again, to bring everything full circle, the law is pervasive. And so, you know, this kind of thing spins off in all kinds of unique questions about why we have federal holidays for a day like Christmas, when that is a religious day for many people. And why is the federal government allowed to declare such a day as a holiday, as opposed to New Year's or Thanksgiving, which really have no inherent religious posture.
And I guess that's one of those page of history kinds of things.
Well, it is. I mean, no court is going to strike down the federal recognition of Christmas Day as a holiday, for starters, because no one wants to have to go work yet another day in the year. But the courts have taken this kind of posture in a lot of religious cases that if things have been around for a while, we're going to recognize, allow those things to pass. There was a case just this past term about a cross erected after the First World War up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., and they allowed that to stand, and they allowed a monument to the Ten Commandments that's on the Capitol grounds in Austin, Texas, to stand just because they've been there for so long. But contrast that with if someone tried to put up a new monument to the Ten Commandments, that might be problematic, as it proved to be in Alabama when the Chief Justice down there did such a thing right in the foyer of the courthouse, state Supreme Courthouse.
Well, that's what you're saying resonates with Justice Holmes's dictum. What was it about the path of the law is not logic, or something like that?
The life of the law is not logic, but experience.
There you go. Okay. So, Richard, thank you very much for joining us, and we'll have you back sometime, and with some other aspect of history and the law, and as it maybe relates to the Americans with Disabilities Act. But we're so glad to have you, but we have run out of time for today's episode of Legal Matters. Thanks again, Richard, for joining us.
My pleasure.
But to our listeners, please be sure to tune in next time on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 2 p.m. We rebroadcast on the following Wednesday at 7 a.m., and then we're available by podcast. We hope you've enjoyed the show and discovered information about today, the law and the history of Christmas. I'm your host, and I want to thank our producer, Missy Hollander, our producer and engineer, a great friend and help for this program. The content of this program is intended for people who are print and visually impaired. After the broadcast, you can find it as a podcast at our website, which is www.ncreadingservice.org. Where you can listen to it again and share it with others. If you have any comments or questions from today's episode or wish to share a topic that you want us to explore, and we encourage you to call us and contact us if there's something you want us to do a program about. We're all ears, and we'll work something up. But please call us at 919-832-5138. And you can also reach us by email at info@ncreading.service.org. And we look forward to hearing from you. And we will be back in the new year, 2020. So thank you so much. Thank you, Richard.